I was also drawn to Dawn's case because last summer, my mom actually passed away from an alcohol death. And so like having Dawn's case essentially like in my back pocket at this time, we were starting to do a lot more for the case. We were bringing in other experts and trying to learn about a bunch of stuff. And so having that paralleled with my mom's textbook alcohol death, it kind of gave me a new perspective of, I had the experience with my mom's death that was what everything should have been, like the proper alcohol death investigation. And so going through that and then revisiting Dawn's case was for me just so much more glaring of something is wrong, because I now personally know what the right thing was and what the right death scene looked like and how the ME was supposed to handle things, how the police are supposed to handle things. And then so having that, and then again, experiencing everything with Dawn's case, it just kind of drove me more to say, like, there's something wrong here and we have to do something about it.
That's Andrea Ciparino, a member of a team of journalists who's investigating the suspicious death of Dawn Pacella.
I think both Dawn and Tony are two unique individuals in this entire situation. Tony has said, like, you know, he's made comments just in private conversations, even of like, he would have served time forever, you know, if it meant that Dawn's outcome wasn't what it was. And even that is such a sacrifice. So I think, to your point, it's like unthinkable that someone would kind of be in that situation.
That's Lexi Kakis, another member of the team creating the YouTube investigation Seeking Justice, which is about Dawn's story.
I feel strongly that this case was botched purposely or maybe not purposely. I mean, I can't be sure of that, but I feel like Dawn, as Andrea said, Dawn's family deserves a reinvestigation, another look, someone who would walk into this unbiased in comparison to what the first medical examiner may have been told or believed. It is heartbreaking to listen to her parents talk about this case. They share all of these little pieces that are questions. You know, where did the phones go? Where is the laptop? Who called her that night as they were leaving? Who was there with her the previous night? They just want to know these answers. And it is around every corner that the Parma Police Department will shut them down on that. They don't want to discuss it. They don't talk to them about it. And so it's re-victimization in my mind. They lost their daughter, but now they can't even get a straight answer. And I think that, you know, my goal is for them to get answers.
That's Dana Pohl, the final member of the team. This is the Silver Linings Handbook podcast. I'm Jason Blair. This is the second of two episodes on Dawn Pacella with three women, Andrea Ciparino, Dana Pohl, and Lexi Kakis, who are investigating Dawn's suspicious death. In the previous episode, we explored what Dawn was like as a child and young woman, what led her to explore criminal justice as a major and a career, and the suspicious circumstances leading up to her firing from the Ohio Attorney General's office and, eventually, her death. We discussed Dawn's conclusion that evidence was going missing from the prosecutor's office, the request by the prosecutor that she illegally wiretap one of the defendants in a mortgage fraud case, Tony Viola, and her eventual decision to reach out to the defense team for Viola and offer to testify about prosecutorial misconduct in his case. We talked about the immense anxiety Dawn appeared to be experiencing toward the end of her life and growing problems with drinking that seemed to snuff out the light that was once in this bright-eyed woman. Today, we're going to dig deeper into the case, exploring, among other things, the star witness against Tony, Catherine Clover, who was given an office in the prosecutor's office and who was later alleged to have been in a sexual relationship with the prosecutor, who was also Don's boss and who also remains in his position in the Cuyahoga County prosecutor's office. We're going to touch on the connections that Lexi, Dana, and Andrea feel to Don, a woman they never knew, and some of their deeply personal motivations for bringing resolution to her case. So I just wanted to thank you, Dana, Lexi, and also Andrea, for the initial part of our conversation. I wanted to go ahead and just jump in where we were before. Lexi, you were telling us about the job interview.
So she had interviewed on that Monday, which I guess would have been the 23rd, I think. And so Tuesday night, her parents came over to her apartment. And in our conversations with the parents, it was common practice for them to kind of sweep the apartment for alcohol just to make sure that wasn't in there. But it did seem like Dawn was starting to kind of take the right steps to move forward from this. And so I guess they left around like 8. They left in the evening, and Dawn was in her apartment. And then sometime in the early morning hours of Wednesday, April 25th, was when we believe that Dawn died. We don't know for certain, but we do know that there was a phone call. There was an inbound phone call, because there was 3 phones found in her apartment. So
someone called her and she picked up? Is that the order?
So there were, like Lexi was saying, there were multiple phones found in the apartment after she is later found deceased. And there is a silver Samsung flip phone with an unknown owner. We don't know whose phone it is. That phone had an outgoing call to Dawn's cell phone at 4:39 a.m., but it calls into question because based on the time of that phone call, the medical examiner put her in, based on her state of rigor mortis, at time of death 8 to 12 hours beforehand, which would mean that Dawn passed away at least a couple hours before this phone call was made to her cell phone. And again, that phone is found in her apartment.
And then the phone is found in the... And what did the medical examiner say she died from?
So they said it was alcohol abuse.
Yeah.
And then it was just an overdose.
Acute. Yeah. And I think we were talking off mic that one of the things that I looked at when I saw that part, because it really struck me, like 0.59 really struck me as a blood alcohol level, because, and we were talking about this before, you know, your body like attempts to reject poison once it starts to kill you, right? Like, and so I looked at the lethal dose for 50% of the population, which is called the LD50. You know, half the people die at this much alcohol, and it's 0.4, it's around a 0.4. And I just thought to myself, like, that doesn't even like, it doesn't operate on a clear bell curve. So it must be like slightly unheard of for someone to be able to successfully get up to a 0.59 without throwing up or letting it go. It's part of the reason why, like, you know, even people attempting to commit suicide, and I'm not going to give like a prescription for how to do it the right way right now, but if they're
good.
Yeah, right.
We don't want that.
No. It's Patreons only. No. But yeah, it doesn't happen the way that I guess people say in the movies. So that one part of the case, just, you know, I find it as unrealistic as the story of Alan Greenberg stabbing herself 20 times. Mm-hmm. Like, it's absurd. Mm-hmm. Like, this,
yeah,
it would require such weird things for it to happen that it just feels implausible.
Yes. I mean, we've done a ton of research into this as well, and we cannot fathom that she consumed that alcohol. She drank that much alcohol. We know that.
Was there evidence of alcohol around?
Yes. I mean, there were bottles of alcohol, but there's other things that kind of contradict it. So there was no vomit. There was, she was fully clothed. She had a belt on, her jeans. There was no, like, the apartment was not messy. So you would think if someone's really, really drunk, they'd be bouncing around or, you know, delirium, knocking things over, all kinds of things like that. And there's no evidence of that at all.
Yeah. And for context, she was maybe 110, 115 pounds. So we're not talking about like a large woman to begin with, which kind of adds to the suspicion of it all.
Interesting. And so, you know, the Emmys report, like one of the things, you know, and of course we'll jump back to other stuff. I know that it was eventually reevaluated again, not the Emmys report, the initial investigation. What was the police department that initially looked into it? It was a local?
Parma Police.
Parma Police. And then the state Emmy. How did it get reexamined? How did that even come about?
So it actually hasn't fully been reexamined. It's been the request has been made for the case to go to the Ohio BCI, but Parma Police has not moved any documents. There has been no
Ohio FBI, right? Bureau of Criminal. Correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So truly the local Parma Police Department, they are the only ones who have taken a look at this case. And I think, you know, going back to part of your original question about this being, you know, ruled an alcohol death, one of the things that we think is pretty strange was at Dawn's apartment, there were papers found from a previous alcohol hospitalization that she had. And we have later learned that an anonymous person, someone requested those documents before she died. And so we don't really know if they got a hold of them or whatever that situation is. But my point being that when the police arrived on the scene, there was already a bias of, we see alcohol bottles, we see open bottles, there's some stuff in the trash related to alcohol. So you have that. And then you see old hospital papers from a previous alcohol incident. And then you see a young woman on the ground, and you put it all together really quickly and say, this must be an alcohol death. So that's really, it seems like what the running theory became. And then when the medical examiner, when the investigator came out to the scene, by the time that they had brought Dawn's body to the pathologist, it's at the top of the paper that she consumed alcohol. So then even the autopsy. So the
investigators are passing on to the medical examiner out of the gate.
Yeah.
So it starts to bias the case, right? Like we were talking about the idea of, you know, that there, even though it shouldn't happen this way, and even though, you know, I think in my experience in dealing with detectives, like maybe when I was a kid, I would have thought the exception would be the callous detective. And what I realized in covering police, the one who is like really there to avenge the dead and treats everybody the same is actually, unfortunately, the exception. And that's not knocking investigators. It is a rough job. It's a hard job, but it's hard not to take shortcuts or not to prioritize based on, the heat you're going to get.
Yeah. And I think too, in this case, like it's understandable to potentially think about that, like, that someone else could have made the call to kind of cover things up or just make things look a certain way, because knowing that, you know, she had really high power bosses and things like that. And she, you know, if she did come forward with this information, she would have probably changed the game, truth be told.
Well, I would expect, like, even if they weren't being shady, just like covering things like this, I would expect there would have been a phone call, because it's their former employee and it's a witness in a case they're involved in. They probably, I mean, whether it's appropriate or what was said, like who the heck knows? But if somebody came to me and said that there was no contact, I would be like, okay, now we're starting with lying, guys. Okay. Because it would just be. So what was the impact of Dawn's death on Tony's case?
I could take this one.
Yeah,
so What's interesting about the day that Dawn was found dead in the evening, so it was Wednesday, April 25th, this was the last day of Tony's state trial. So Dawn was going to be the last witness coming in with documents to talk about the misconduct and then obviously to present the evidence that exonerated Tony. And
so this is the end of the defense after the prosecution's case in chief, end of the defense's main case. Now we're bringing in a witness who says, oh, they've been hiding all this and this is not. So like sort of your witness for the defense.
I mean, essentially. And so when Dawn obviously doesn't show up for court, they immediately move to closing arguments and the jury starts deliberating. So when Dawn is found deceased at the end of that day, the next morning on the 26th, Tony is brought up to court and Judge Daniel Gall makes an announcement to everybody that Dawn Pacella, who was going to, who would have spoken the day before, who wasn't able to come in, she was found deceased in her home. And, you know, I think, and Tony talks about this in previous interviews, and he's going to talk about it more next week in our episode, but the courtroom is kind of in shock that there are a lot of people who are very upset because it's shocking. You have a woman who she was about to speak about unspeakable misconduct and she's found dead.
We're even thinking about it from Tony's perspective. Here's this woman who befriended me because her bosses were doing this X, Y, or Z, who was like brave enough, because like we all have a hard enough time like admitting our minor mistakes. Rarely do we like voluntarily without pressure turn to somebody and say, we've betrayed you in an enormous way. And then on top of that, add that not only have I betrayed you, I'm now willing to help you. And this could keep you from going into prison. Like, I'm just trying to imagine sitting in his shoes in that moment where he first heard she was dead. How, like, not just his case, but this person, right? Like, how rare is it we run into somebody in our own lives who's willing to, like, basically turn themselves in for something that huge? And then, I mean, it's just rare. It's just rare.
I think both Dawn and Tony are two unique individuals. In this entire situation, Tony has said, like, you know, he's made comments just in private conversations, even of like, he would have served time forever, you know, if it meant that Dawn, you know, Dawn's outcome wasn't what it was. And even that is such a sacrifice. So I think to your point, it's like unthinkable that someone would kind of be in that situation.
I mean, and this is why I say, like, when listening to the story, like, you can't make it up. Like, this is like the Hollywood. It wouldn't even land with a Hollywood treatment. Like, does Tony talk about that? Talk about what that moment felt like when he heard that? What does he say?
I mean, he has told us that he was in shock. He was, you know, devastated. He carried guilt. I mean, he immediately felt guilty because, you know, she was helping him. And I think it was just pure, he was devastated by it. And not, like you said, not just because she didn't testify. I mean, he was already, they had already, the jury was deliberating. So that piece was over and done. It was the loss of Dawn, the fears that he knew she had, the, you know, all the extra steps she was taking to be safe. Now we're just, he realized how serious those really were. You know, she was possibly, you know, right, to have those fears. I mean, what happened could be directly related.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really struck me in your interview with him, which I really recommend people go back and listen to your first episode, was this: he was telling the story of like finding out about it, right? I was waiting for him to say, and I felt so betrayed, right? Like, because that's going to be the natural reaction. But one of the things that really struck me in just the way he was naturally talking about it was his just genuine concern for her. And being concerned about like her anxiety or her worry or thinking something might have been going on in her personal life, and he still cared enough to engage about it like that. I mean, yeah, like in some ways, just the loss. Yeah, it's.
Tony will say over and over again when we're talking to him, well, I'm no saint. And I think that we disagree. I think that, you know, we have learned enough about Tony to know that he has a huge heart. He is a real people person. He cares about people. He built his business to, you know, be successful, but he did that through caring about his customers, caring about the employees who worked for him. And so we feel very lucky to have met Tony, and we just think we can't say enough good things about Tony.
So Sophie has a question, which we probably haven't said super clearly, and it's about the specific misconduct that she uncovered. So maybe just sort of like summing up what the bullet point list of what we thought she would testify to might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. So, and just to say, Sophie, we're not trying to be shady and like keep it from like sharing. We know Tony is going to speak at length about this next week in our episode. And obviously a lot of this information is already online. So again, we're not trying to hide anything from you. The high level points of the misconduct that she first witnessed was as the office manager, since it was her job to kind of, you know, look over the evidence in all of these over 1,000 cases. Like Dana was talking about earlier, the way that the evidence was first being handled was just incorrect. So nothing is being locked. Anybody could have access to things. And Dawn was telling friends and family that she noticed that files were going missing. Evidence in cases was being destroyed. Her signature to get files in and out of whatever process they had, her signature was being falsified. And so people were faking being her trying to get evidence. So that's one thing. There's a woman that Tony will talk about in our episode next week who began in this case as a defendant. So she was being accused of these crimes. And by the end of the story, you will learn she's essentially no longer a defendant. There's a woman who was sleeping with one of the prosecutors. And she
one
has,
of my favorite characters in this whole movie.
Yes. Her name is Catherine Clover, and she has her hand in pretty much all of these cases, which is just highly illegal and unethical.
When you say hand, what do you mean?
So Dawn witnessed Catherine Clover, first of all, getting her own office inside of the task force. So, I mean, just like taking a step back and thinking about that, right? She was a defendant. She was being accused of mortgage fraud.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then so the defendant now has an office in prosecutor's office.
In the task force that's supposed to prosecute her, which is just unheard of. And she develops what ends up being a documented sexual affair with Dan Caceres, again, Dawn's boss. And Dan Caceres often used Catherine Clover as a witness in cases. So Catherine Clover would go up on the stand and lie about a lot of things within this case. And so Dawn witnessed all of this start to happen. And the chain of command of who she would be able to tell about this misconduct were the people doing the misconduct. And so that was, yeah, that was making a lot of impact in this case.
So with Catherine, she was testifying in multiple cases, had an office in the, was a defendant, had an office in the prosecutor's office, and had a romantic relationship with, was it Dawn's boss?
It's Dan Caceres. Okay. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow.
So, yep, you'll hear a lot more about her next week. But so, yeah, like I said, she had her hand in a lot of stuff that was going on at the task force.
Was any of the, you know, I know that prosecutors never keep all of the information that they collect because they collect plenty of information that may not be relevant or they don't know it's relevant at the time. Was any of the information that she felt was being thrown out considered exculpatory in any of the cases? or that she thought was exculpatory, or suggested that the defendants didn't actually commit the crime?
Well, yeah. I mean, Dawn, one of the things that the documents that she kept and then ended up giving to Tony to help exonerate him in his state trial, it was a document that, I don't know all the mortgage stuff. I know Tony can say this much better than me. But essentially, the document proved that not only Tony, but a lot of other people who were accused of this mortgage fraud and making no money down loans and things of that nature, anyway, that they were not defrauding banks, that the banks knew what they were doing.
Which is sort of like the key for mortgage fraud. It's not so much
fraud,
like what you do, because there are plenty of things that are legal to do with like a mortgage or a financial instrument. As long as the parties have knowledge, that's what you're doing, right? The question becomes, who knew what and what documentation do you have that says these people knew?
Yeah. So I think Dawn really realized this when she sat in on a meeting with a bank and they were going over documents and they were handing them to the banker and saying, you know, is this loan legit? Is this what you really were offering to people? And he went down through and he's like, yeah, this is what we were doing. And so Dawn realized at that moment, there's absolutely no fraud here. Like, I don't know what you're doing, but this is not. And she brought that to their attention. If this is your case, they just admitted that these loans are legit. So how are you going to charge these people? And they kind of ignored her. They didn't want to hear that.
Wow. Wow. And Tony's telling us that some of the evidence that she gave him included FBI reports, bank lending program documents, and sort of showed that the theory was wrong. And then Sophie, who's always researching, mentioned that Dan dumped his laptop. Tell me about that.
You got it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Generally, so, not a sign, not a good sign.
The innocence, that's for sure.
No. Just after Dawn's body is found, there are personal emails that have been made public where Dan Caceres admits that he dumped and got rid of his laptop, which, again, and I'm sure Tony will pop a comment here, missing laptops and missing files is a common thread in his case in the federal trial. The laptops go missing and then
computers go missing.
A Dawn's computer is missing.
All Tony's compute, all the evidence that they collected, supposedly, quote unquote. Yeah.
From his missing ones from.
And from the. Yes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And they and they still were able to go forward with the case. So in Tony's first trial, this is during his first trial. And that is that the state or the federal trial? That's the state trial.
Federal is the first one.
He is convicted or acquitted at that point?
Convicted
in the first one where Dawn doesn't show up. And then acquitted in the second one, right? Or am I...
Yes.
Yeah.
But Dawn wasn't involved in the first trial. I mean, she wasn't going to testify in the first trial. Yeah, she was testifying in the second trial.
Okay. So that makes sense. So you've got, so she dies. The investigation begins by the local police department. Tony, you said, spent 9 years, right? 9 years in jail. And Tony had mentioned in the chat, and you guys had mentioned that the investigation hasn't been reopened, but the sheriff's department did look into it. What prompted that? What prompted the sheriff's department to look into the investigation itself? Was there a complaint, a concern, the parents' efforts?
So there's a local attorney. Her name is Kim Corral, and she's an absolute rock star, and she's been working on Tony's case, and then also by extension, Dawn's case. And she was able to get the sheriffs to relook at the case. And we have some great documents from just their recommendations of what should be redone, what wasn't done correctly the first time when Dawn's body was found. And it's their recommendation that Dawn's case gets reopened by Parma. But ultimately, even after that recommendation, Parma simply refused. So that's why the case has never been reopened by Parma.
Okay. Okay. So it's never, even though the recommendation is on the table. So I'm going to shift gears for a sec. How do you guys end up together pursuing this case, and like why, out of all the many different cases, why this case and why this format? It sounds like Andrea came to you first.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Yeah. So I obviously learned about the case from Tony reaching out to Uncovered. And I mean, it was pretty much a thing where like we agreed as Uncovered to put Dawn's case on the site. And that's pretty much like as far as the Uncovered commitment went. It was, yep, we're going to visualize our case. We're going to research it, do the timeline, do the narrative, do the whole thing. And we're going to post it on the site. And like, that's as much as we can promise. But even after, as Uncovered, the three of us like fulfilled that promise, we found ourselves keep coming back to the case. And again, I think it comes back to a lot of what we were saying before of like, Dawn was someone that we could see ourselves being friends with and feeling like this kind of kinship to her and to her case. Felt like we had to keep doing more about it. I personally, I was also drawn to Dawn's case because last summer, my mom actually passed away from an alcohol death. And so, thank you. And so, like, having Dawn's case essentially like in my back pocket at this time, we were starting to do a lot more for the case. We were bringing in other experts and trying to learn about a bunch of stuff. And so having that paralleled with my mom's textbook alcohol death, it kind of gave me a new perspective of, I had the experience with my mom's death that was what everything should have been, like the proper alcohol death investigation. And so going through that and then revisiting Dawn's case was, for me, just so much more glaring of, something is wrong, because I now personally know what the right thing was and what the right death scene looked like and how the ME was supposed to handle things, how the police are supposed to handle things. And then so having that, and then again, experiencing everything with Dawn's case, it just kind of drove me more to say, like, there's something wrong here and we have to do something about it.
What were the things that stuck out to you that were different?
So one of the main things, and you know, we know about this with Dawn's case, is there were 6 police officers who arrived on the scene after her parents in the apartment building called for a wellness check, which 6 is a lot. And her family has even said before that, with a couple different wellness checks that they made, only 2 officers arrived. So first, with my mom, it's the same thing. 2 officers arrived. That's like what you would expect. And then some other just quick things with my mom's death. And I know Dana talked about this before, of just some things that you would see in an alcohol death. There was evidence of like my mom's body shutting down, you know, like what you would normally have with alcohol, of trying to expel what you've consumed. And, you know, other things of like stuff being knocked around, because again, you're intoxicated. In Dawn's case, we don't see any of that. And then even down to like the police, my mom passed away in Stanhope, New Jersey. So it's like super suburban. Mm-hmm. The police talked to the neighbors, you know, just to right. like get a better idea of like of my mom and like what her story was. In Dawn's case, they never spoke to the neighbors. They never even pulled security cam footage in the apartment. And you're talking about people are sharing walls, you know, right. In my mom's death, there's acres between other houses. So it's just like the way that my mom's death was handled versus how Dawn's death was handled. But ultimately, the ruling is the same. It just doesn't make sense.
Has it been hard for you with your mom's death to, I was just thinking that, like, I'm not sure whether it would be therapeutic or whether it'd be painful or whether
it's... No, it's a good question. Yeah. I think I'm still trying to figure out the answer for myself, but I lean very heavily on Dana and Lexi of just this whole process of, you know, I feel like I've been going through my own grieving process with my mom, but so much of working on Dawn's case feels cathartic because it's, you know, again, knowing what is a genuine alcohol death, and then seeing this to someone who I feel like could have been my friend, it's just more of a reason to want to fight for a reinvestigation, honestly.
Yeah. It's in a weird way, like, it allows you to, it's gonna sound weird, but my mom passed away in October, and it allows you to take something out of that bad thing that happened to you, that really bad thing, and turn it into something good for people. And, you know, I tell people all the time, like, my mom dying, nothing like I expected, but one of the things that I didn't expect, in addition to like the loneliness and all that stuff, is that there can be gifts from loss. And it's nice to be able to have the opportunity to turn them into something good. And I talk about the same thing with my career at the New York Times, where, you know, I plagiarized, I fabricated, created giant scandals, and created all sorts of mess. But it's amazing to be at a point right now where so much good can come out of it. So, you know, I'm thinking of, as you're talking about that, what a mixed blessing it is, but what a blessing it still is for you. Like, who would have thought in the moment where you're dealing with that stuff with your mom that in less than a year, you would be taking that and turning it into something good for someone's life. And it's kind of admirable.
Yeah. Right? Like, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's one of those things, and sorry to hear about your mom. I know grief is never linear, and sometimes it sneaks up on you. You know, I think it was just so interesting for, you know, for me with everything. My mom's name is actually also Dawn. And so when we started to learn about Dawn's case and researching it last spring, there was always like something in me of, I always kind of felt like my mom was going to succumb to her own addictions and that it would kind of end similarly. But then to have it be so paralleled, I mean, I remember when I was on the phone with the medical examiner and my mom's death, of like going over the autopsy report with them about my mom. And so much of what I was doing for her was really for me, for Dawn's case, because there was so much of like, you have to explain this to me. I have to understand the BAC. I have to understand all this stuff, because I was trying to apply the same knowledge to Dawn. And I feel like, again, it's just kind of giving me another reason to really push for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I admire it. Mm-hmm. So
thank you.
We do too.
Yeah, as do
we. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite often we let her know that.
I wanted to add to that. So you know, we all have what drove us towards the case. And I think from my perspective, part of it is the work that Tony did. So for 9.5 years in prison, he was requesting documents, he was pulling files, he was, you know, working really, really hard to gather all of the information that you'll see in the evidence locker. And that was not just for him. That was because he was fighting for Dawn. And I think, you know, to have all of that information to, you know, we can look at the scene and we can, you know, say this, or we can hear what Tony says, but when he backs it up with a document, there's no doubting that, you know, that's a source, and that is valid. And that proves everything that Tony is saying. And so I think that for me, it was his work needs to now help Dawn's family. We need, you know, he needs help with that. He assembled a team that is incredible. He has a PI. He has attorney Kim Correll. He has Yale Law School involved in this, and they are looking at, you know, they're handling some requests for documents, determining whether or not they should be released or not. I mean, he has an amazing team of, he pulled all of them together, and then he reached out to us. And we're, I think we feel so grateful that he did, because it is a very strong, very focused team. And my hope is that this, the result of seeking justice, the result of all of Tony's work and everybody who's involved, will lead to Dawn's cause of death being changed from natural to homicide, and a review of the case so that we can know, even if they change it to undetermined, just it wasn't natural. We do not believe.
I was going to ask you, like, who can pull that lever? Who can change, like, legally? Is it
a medical examiner or a pathologist?
State medical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it really is like the Greenberg case, where like it's the stubbornness of the state medical examiner. Not, you know, it's mm-hmm. just so funny to me. I was recently having a conversation with actually a prosecutor about this, which is like, it is so hard for people, for professionals to like turn around and kind of do what Don did, which is like say, I'm wrong. I screwed up. I want to do things a little bit differently. And I think if more of us could do that, probably myself included, I think we'd be in a much better place in our personal relationships and our professional work when it comes to things like this and injustice, just being willing to be sort of like humble enough to let go of the idea, like, I thought this guy was guilty. Like so much of this, if they just could have conceded in the beginning, I thought this guy was guilty and oh, oops, we were wrong. Like we're because regardless whether it's a homicide or it's not, it's a safe bet that she probably wouldn't have died then mm-hmm. if things hadn't happened, no matter what you believe about it. I want to give you guys a chance for closing thoughts, give anybody in the chat a chance to ask you guys some questions, but I just wanted to like see what, I mean, I think, as much as I find it moving the case, I find Don's story moving. I find Tony moving personally. I find like the fact that it seems like Tony would pursue this case, Don's case for justice, even if he were exonerated, you know, tomorrow. I find all that moving, but I also find like listening to you guys today and, you know, I know you, Dana, and where you're coming from and Lexi, hearing you talk about it and especially you, Andrea, listening to you talk about that, like, you know, it's just, it's really, as much as I'm impressed by those other things, I'm impressed by you guys. The fact that you would take time out of your lives, I'm sure you're not making billions on this, or probably anything, right? It's less than nothing negative. But that you would take your time, you would put your hearts, you would put your emotions into this. And I want to give you just a chance for any closing thoughts that you want to share with people.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I would say for, you know, my closing thought truly is that Dawn deserves an investigation, you know, and knowing what we know about her case, and we're really looking forward to viewers and listeners learning the same amount, that at the end of the day, her death was not properly investigated. Whatever you want to think about what the ruling should be of whether it was, you know, actually a homicide or not, that regardless, her death was not investigated the way it should have been. And just a reinvestigation will, we think, bring up new evidence that would prove that something suspicious happened.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Dana?
So I feel strongly that this case was botched purposely or maybe not purposely. I mean, I can't be sure of that, but I feel like Don, as Andrea said, Don's family deserves a reinvestigation, another look, someone who would walk into this unbiased in comparison to what the first medical examiner may have been told or believed. It is heartbreaking to listen to her parents talk about this case. They share all of these little pieces that are questions. You know, where did the phones go? Where is the laptop? Who called her that night as they were leaving? Who was there with her the previous night? You know, why?
Nobles that are unknown. Things that
right, could have been exactly. Known. They just want to know these answers. And it is around every corner that the Parma Police Department will shut them down on that. They don't want to discuss it. They don't talk to them about it. And so it's re-victimization in my mind. They lost their daughter, but now they can't even get a straight answer. And I think that, you know, my goal is for them to get answers.
Answers. Mm-hmm. Answers for the family. How about you, Lexi?
Yeah, I mean, I echo exactly what Andrea and Dana had said. I mean, as we've gotten to know her parents, it just reinforces that, like, they need justice for their daughter. Like, it is so obvious that something went awry. We don't know necessarily where that was, but something did happen. But I also do feel so incredibly hopeful that seeking justice could really be that platform to quite literally seek justice for Dawn in this case. And I am so lucky that I get to work with Dana and Andrea on this, because I feel like we really make the best team in the world to kind of go on all these little side missions and rabbit holes and all these things. Like, it's been a challenge. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's been hard to understand it all. It's taken me 4 or 5 times to truly understand the case. But now that I'm here, it's like, we just got to get something done, you know?
I have this image in my head, and I'm not going to ask you it, guys, whether you're going to, but I could see this possibly being replicated again. we'll let you focus on the first case now. But real quickly for everybody, tell us where else we can find you guys in addition to Seeking Justice. I know Dana has her own podcast. Lexi, you're a co-host of one. Where can people find you guys in addition to Seeking Justice? And where can they find you for Seeking Justice?
Sure. So we have a website, Seeking Justice Media, that Andrea wonderfully created for us. So we have all of our YouTube episodes, and essentially we're taking both the YouTube content and putting it on a podcast stream, so you can find it probably on the Friday after we air there, because Dana's working really hard on that. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. We started on, like, we're only going to be on 2 platforms, and that quickly grew to, like,
to 4. You guys are the only ones who like my TikToks.
So it's been really fun to kind of expand our horizons that way. But yeah, so we can share a link tree with everyone of where we are, but I believe we're the Justice Show on TikTok, right? We're Seeking Justice Pod, I think, on TikTok, Seeking Justice on Facebook, and then Seeking Justice Pod, I think, on Instagram as well.
If you look that up, I think you'll find our little SJ. And if not, yeah.
And then you're also co-hosting The Broken System with Robert Armour.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So that's a fun gig.
Yeah. Dana, where else can we find you?
You can find me at True Crime PI Podcast on all of your favorite podcast platforms, and also on Instagram. It's under True Crime PI. You can search me on Twitter, same, or I always say Twitter, I can't get it, on X. I'm also on TikTok, but I'm not super active there.
I will go into the ground calling it Twitter.
I know. But I also have a Facebook group for True Crime PI and a Facebook page.
No, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. I will have to come join. And then last but not least.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty much on every platform, and I'm just Andrea N. Cipriano. You'll find me there. Okay.
Are you still doing your blog?
Oh, my blog. Yeah. It's alive. It's out there. It's thecrimesheet.com. I mean, it's literally hasn't been touched since like 2020, I guess. But I've got old stuff on there. You could find it.
Good stuff remains good.
I will say that you can also, I'm only putting you on the spot, Andrea, because I love you, that you can find her on the News Nation show.
Oh, yes.
That's coming out
soon.
That's
right. Yeah.
Have you gotten a date on that? Have you gotten a date on?
No, I don't know. I'm considered a citizen detective expert, which is way too nice. But I'm going to be featured in the new CW show called Crime Nation, and I'm going to be in the episode about the Gilgo Lisk situation, talking about the victims. So,
oh, nice, yeah,
that's out there.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
So it looks like we don't have any other questions that we didn't cover from the chat, guys. So, drum roll, thank you. I'll do my partial yada yada. Everybody can find us, God knows where, on every social media platform, even Threads. We also have a listener-run Facebook group called the Silver Linings Fireside Chat. And if you guys aren't in there, you should be in there because we talk.
Yep. I'm in there.
And I'm sure we will be talking about you more. I'm Jason Blair, and this is the Silver Linings Handbook Podcast. We'll see you all again next week.